Okay, let's get started. Welcome everyone who's joining us here on Zoom, as well as those of us joining on Facebook Live. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, welcome from wherever you are joining today. My name is Sarah Vanja and I serve as the director of the Alliance for Science, and I'm a professor at the Boyce Thompson Institute on the Cornell University campus. Thank you for joining us today, our first AFS Live of the new year. The future faces of gene editing in agriculture. I can't think of a better way to start the new year than hearing from rising scientists. We're going to meet three of those rising star scientists who are using gene editing or CRISPR to develop crops and livestock that will be more climate resilient in the face of global climate change and associated resource limitations. Our guests today are going to share a quick glimpse of their research. And then we're going to discuss together with all of you the role that this genomic tool has for helping work toward a better sustained planet. So let's go ahead and jump in and meet our guests. I'll introduce each of them in turn, in reverse order in which they'll speak. Our last speaker will be Nicholas Karavolias. He's currently a PhD student at the University of California, and he works at the Innovative Genomics Institute that was founded by Nobel Prize winner and CRISPR champion Jennifer Doudna. And there he uses CRISPR to improve rice to make it more climate resilient, particularly more drought tolerant. And this is work that he'll share with us today. He holds a BS in agricultural science from Cornell University. Proud of that. And Nicholas has spearheaded a number of volunteer efforts to broaden participation in STEM fields, and he enjoys teaching and mentoring undergrads at Berkeley. He's also a fellow of the Rocky Farr Fellows Program. Our second speaker today will be Dr. Navneet Kaur. She's a postdoc at Rothamsted Research, and she is a plant genome editing specialist. She's working on applying CRISPR-Cas9 for characterization and improvement of agriculturally important traits, such as disease resistance, abiotic stress tolerance, yield, and micronutrient uptake and assimilation. She works in wheat, rice, and pulse crops. All crops very important to her native India. And she's also very focused on applying the tools of genome editing to nutrition and improving nutrition. Currently, she's using a CRISPR knock-in approach to improve nutrition in rice. And her PhD research focused on a better understanding of the genes involved in vitamin A production in banana. And in her research, she developed banana cultivars with dramatically more provitamin A. And so these are bananas that could play a significant role in helping eradicate vitamin A deficiency in parts of the developing world. Our first speaker is Macy Mueller. She's a PhD candidate in animal biology at the University of California, Davis. She earned her bachelor's in animal science with a minor in political science from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and her master's in animal biology from UC Davis. She's currently conducting research in Dr. Allison Van Eneman's Animal Genomics and Biotechnology Lab. And in 2021, she was awarded a USDA NEFA pre-doctoral fellowship and was a Foundation for Food and Agriculture, or FAR, fellow. So we have two FAR fellows with us today. Her ultimate career goal is to provide research and education that results in the expanded availability and application of genetic-based biotechnologies in livestock production systems to improve animal health and welfare and enhance production efficiency, very much aligned with the Alliance for Science mission. So welcome, Nicholas, Navneet, and Macy. We're now going to enter the show and tell portion of the hour, where our three speakers will give us a brief 5 to 8 minute overview of their work. I encourage you all to use the chat function or the Q&A functions on your platform, either Facebook Live or on Zoom, as we go along so that we can address your comments and questions after all three speakers have presented. So I'm going to ask Macy to share your screen and kick us off today. Over to you, Macy.
Can I get a thumbs up if this is working? Great. Okay. Thank you for the introduction, Sarah, and thank you to the Alliance for Science for hosting such an important topic. I'm really excited to be able to share about some of my graduate research and the motivations behind it. So as Sarah mentioned, I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of California, Davis, but I'm originally from Nebraska, which is part of the Great Plains in the center of the United States. And here I grew up helping my family build and grow our first generation Angus cattle ranch. And from an early age, I fell in love with cattle. And then as I became more involved with our operation, I began to see the important role that animal science research and specifically genetics played in our ability to improve both our animals and their resulting products. And these experiences eventually led me to graduate school at UC Davis. And at UC Davis, my research is focused on using biotechnology, specifically gene editing, to improve livestock production. So a little bit about gene editing. It's a tool that we can use to precisely add, delete, or replace letters of the genetic code, which allows us to influence a specific trait of interest. In livestock, this could be things like thermal tolerance or disease resistance. And the great thing about gene editing is that it allows us to make these changes in as little as one generation, which is much faster than traditional breeding methods. And we can think of gene editing as using molecular scissors to cut and change the DNA or the genetic code. And this genetic code is what contains the instructions for making and maintaining the different traits of the animal, kind of like a recipe book. And so we can know that if we change the genetic code or the recipe, then that will be able to change the traits of the animal. So the first project that I've worked on was using gene editing to edit an important trait for animal welfare, which is polled or hornless. So I'll explain a little bit of that. So certain breeds of cattle, for example, the majority of dairy cattle, like the black and white one seen on the left here, are born with horns. And these horns are a danger to both human handlers and the other animals. So they're typically removed at a young age through a process known as dehorning. And although this is an important process to protect the animals and handlers, it can be painful for the animal. So an alternative is polled or hornless genetics that are naturally found in some beef cattle breeds. And in 2015, Carlson et al. Successfully used gene editing to introduce these polled genetics into a typically horned dairy breed, Holsteins. And so we can see here the first calf that was born. And as you can see, he doesn't have horns and never did grow horns, unlike his parents. And so what my research did was investigated how we could use gene editing to rapidly increase the number of polled dairy animals in the entire population, therefore decreasing or eliminating the need for dehorning. So the question I was asking is, can we use gene editing to make all dairy calves hornless? And to understand this, we have to know that the dairy cattle industry uses a reproductive technology that allows only a few hundred fathers to, compared to the 9 million mother cows. And so this is an important feature because what my research found is that we can use gene editing in just the top 1%, so a very small number of the fathers. And then through reproductive technologies, these gene edited hornless fathers can produce many hornless calves. And so we can see on the graph here, on the y-axis, we have the frequency of horns, which we want to decrease from the current rate, the red line, which is at almost 100%. And if we use gene editing, which is the green line, we can decrease this so that in 3 years, we would have 50% less dehorning. And in 20 years, we could have no dehorning. And so this really shows the power of gene editing to improve an animal welfare trait. However, these reproductive technologies that allow the dairy industry to produce many calves from a few fathers are not widely used across the globe and especially in beef cattle production. So this leads me to my next project. So the reason that these reproductive technologies are not widely used across the globe or in beef cattle is because they can be logistically difficult and labor intensive to implement, especially in beef cattle production, which, as we can see from the picture on the right, are primarily raised in extensive grazing systems. And so this results in most beef calves being produced by natural service mating. And compared to reproductive technologies where one bull can have thousands of calves, by natural service, one bull can only breed about 30 cows per year. And so this will mean that a large number of bulls will be needed to breed all of the beef cattle and to pass on those potentially beneficial gene-edited traits to the next generation. So my current research is investigating an alternative method to make the transfer of these gene-edited traits and potentially elite genetics to the next generation more efficient. And this alternative method is called surrogate sires. And a surrogate sire would be a host bull that produces reproductive cells with elite donor sire genetics instead. And so the surrogate sire will be able to pass on these desirable and beneficial gene edited traits through natural service, which will allow widespread distribution of gene edited traits in species that are typically raised in extensive grazing systems like cattle or sheep. And so I think this is a really important next step for how we'll be able to use gene editing in livestock production. So with that, I would like to thank you all for listening, and I'm really excited to continue this conversation. I'd also like to thank all of the members of the Van Inenem Lab and the funding sources that have made this research possible. And a special shout out to the Rocky Farr Fellows, which has been a really great experience in broadening my understanding and perspective of agriculture and making great connections with people like Nicholas. So thank you very much and looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Macy. Great overview. Thanks for sharing that glimpse of your research. We're going to turn now to Navneet, who is joining us from the UK, and she is going to share her screen momentarily. Navneet, are you able to-
Can I ask Chris to share the slides, please?
Sure. Chris, can you share the slides?
There you go.
Great. And Navneet, if you yes. wanted to turn your camera on, it's currently off.
Okay.
Is it great. Over to you? Yeah, looks great. Thanks.
Thank you. Hello everyone. I am Navneet and I'm from India. And during my PhD, I worked on banana biofortification to alleviate vitamin A deficiency. And currently I am at Rothamsted Research and as a postdoctoral scientist. Next slide, please. As we all know, vitamin A deficiency is a preventable cause for childhood blindness, and many children go blind each year due to this deficiency. And due to that, we need different solutions so that we can provide a better source of vitamin A to the children. Next slides. Carotenoids are natural precursor for vitamin A. Carotenoids can be obtained from the plant sources, or we can have vitamin A from the animal sources in the storage form, which can be converted to the retinal and further used for the our body functions and for the metabolic reactions. Next slide, please. And why I chose banana? Because banana is an important staple crop for different countries, and it has been like year-round convenient, and it is affordable, and different varieties, valid nutrition. It has been like one of the staple crop after rice, wheat, and corn. And in case of scientific perspective, the many cultivated varieties of banana are triploid in nature. Hence, they don't have pollen, viable pollens, and they are sterile, and they provide natural barrier for the cross-pollination. Hence, they are very good plant material for the genetic engineering. Next slide, please. Next. Yeah, so in case of plants, carotenoids are synthesized by carotenoid biosynthetic pathway, and this substrate has been provided by the MEP pathway, that is the plastidial pathway. And here the DXS is a rate limiting enzyme for this substrate pathway, where in case of carotenoid biosynthesis pathway, PSY is one of the important rate limiting enzyme, while this LCY, this cyclases, play an important role in diverting the flux from lycopene towards alpha carotene or beta carotene. The beta carotene has like double the efficiency to get converted into the vitamin A as compared to the alpha carotene. So during my PhD, I did overexpression study and knockout study. In overexpression study, I increased the flux of this substrate gene, that is BXS, while in knockout study, I knock out this lycopene cyclase epsilon gene so that the flux from the alpha carotene side can be diverted toward the beta carotene, and there will be more beta carotene and hence will be more vitamin A can be consumed. While doing this CRISPR-Cas knockout study, I also established this CRISPR-Cas first by silencing this PDS gene in case of banana. Next slide, please. So this is my workflow, how I started. First of all, the very first step was to in silico analyzing the genes I want to work upon. Once I selected the genes, I characterized them by gene expression studies as well as functional complementation studies in bacterial culture. Once those candidate genes were selected, I started my tissue culture work and transformed and targeted the genes, the candidate genes. And these are different stages my plants went through. First is tissue culture, then to the greenhouse, then to the net house, and finally the fruits obtained, and they were analyzed by different methods, and one was HPLC. Next slides. And how I started, first of all, the very first step of my research was to screen the contrasting cultivars in India, because I must know which variety has the lowest and which has the highest to select the genes. So I screened 10 varieties where I found that Rustali has the lowest carotenoid content while Nandhran has the highest carotenoid content, especially beta carotene. So I selected these lines to study further. Next slide. And to characterize the DXS gene, which is the part of the metabolic pathway, that is substrate metabolic pathway, DXS, I overexpress gene. So before overexpressing, I need to select the candidate gene. So I did tissue-specific expression analysis from Rustali and Nandhran in unripe and ripe fruit. And I observed that in case of Nandhran, if you see these three homologs, the DXS2 was having very high expression in unripe as well as ripe condition. While in case of Rustali, in case of unripe pulp, DXS1 having high expression, while in case of ripe pulp, the expression was lowered very low. So I used isolated these Nandhran 3 genes, DXS1, 2, and 3, and functionally complemented with PAC beta plasmid. PAC beta has carotenoid cassadinates. Once it is complemented with the DXS, it will produce more carotenoids. So I observed the carotenoid content in the bacterial culture, and I found that Nandhran DX2 is one of the candidate genes which can help us increase the carotenoid content. Next slide. So I prepared a construct where I transformed, I put this DXS gene under the ubiquitin promoter and transformed into the banana cultivar, that is Grandin. And finally, I got a product where the carotenoid content was increased up to the 20-fold, especially the beta carotene. And there is a beta carotene equivalence where beta carotene plus half of the alpha carotene can contribute to the beta carotene. So I can say this variety had a huge increase in the beta carotene, which can be used to alleviate vitamin A deficiency. Next slide. Further, as I wanted to use CRISPR technique for biofortifying the banana, first I established my CRISPR technique in banana by targeting PDS gene, which once it got knockout, affects the chloroplast color and gives a phenotypic effect. That is, the plants go albino. Next slide, please. So after targeting the PDS gene in the banana, I found out that there were like clear albino plants and there was variegated phenotypes in the plants developed. And I also sequenced those plants and I found there was different deletions and addition of the nucleotides leading to the creating the stop codons and hence making them albino or chimeric. The chimeric effect was also due to, because banana is triploid in nature, so sometimes there was like only two genomes got edited, either one. And I also observed the chlorophyll and carotenoid content in these lines, and there was also reduction in the chlorophyll content as well as the total carotenoid content. And after establishing this CRISPR-Cas in banana, I went for targeting that lycopene cyclase epsilon. Next slide, please. To target this lycopene epsilon cyclase, I isolated the genes and sequence and prepared this target, and then transformed that construct into the banana plant, that is through tissue culture by agrobacterium mediated transformation. And these are the different stages of the plant my plants went through. And after screening the positively transformed plants, I went for the genome sequencing of these plants. Next slide. And I found that there was like a deletion and one addition of T nucleotide. So I had nearly four type of different mutations, which lead to termination of the protein sequences and hence increase in the beta carotene content in leaves. And after that leaf analysis, I went for the fruit analysis. Next slide. And this is the fruit developed after CRISPR-Cas technology in case of banana after targeting the lycopene epsilon cyclase. And there was nearly six-fold increase in the carotenoid content. And this content was not as much as compared to the overexpression, but when I studied the gene expression of different genes in this pathway, I observed there was like increase in the downstream genes, which was leading to the sink, and that could be the one reason that the content wasn't increased. Next slide, please. At present at Rothamsted Research, I am working on rice and towards in developing enhanced resistance to blast disease by using CRISPR-Cas. And this blast disease is one of the devastating disease in rice varieties, and it is caused by the fungus Magnoporthia oryzae. Next, please. And in case of plants, they have their own immune system. And with that immune system, they have receptors. And these receptors can help them recognize effector proteins from the different pathogens. So in case of rice, they have this PIC gene, which have different alleles, which can recognize different effector proteins from this this Magnoporthia oryzae and can provide resistance. So different alleles can provide resistance to different type of micro this fungus factors. So there are like BEAC factors, which can be detected by P, either K or M. In this case, in my study, right, currently I'm trying to replace the PIC M HMA domain with the PIC-P HMA domain, because this is the most variable part of the both of these alleles, and this provides binding to the effector. So by changing this effector, this homology, this HMA domain, I can increase the resistance to the this fungus. Next slide, please. So by replacing PIC-P HMA domain with PIC MHMA domain by using knock-in approach, I'm trying to develop this rice blast resistant variety. Next slide, please. There are already many practical applications of genome editing have proved in crop improvement, such as this is a big list where they have been used to provide biotic tolerance, abiotic tolerance, or by increasing the nutritional enhanced crops. And also in case of like in wheat, there has been resistance to powdery mildew, and which is a great achievement. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, I would like to say genome editing tool can play important role towards improving agronomical important traits in plant to provide food security under changing climate condition. Thank you.
Thank you, Navneet. And what, excuse me, what a dramatic difference, visual difference in those CRISPR bananas that are now rich with provitamin A. So thank you so much for that tour. We're going to turn now to our final speaker, Nicholas, who is not going to use slides today. So maybe we can, Chris, maybe we can put him on center stage. Over to you, Nicholas, take it away.
Well, thank you, Macy and Navneet, for kicking that off. Those were some of the coolest cows and bananas I've ever seen. I hope you're not paying too much attention to my face and we'll pay attention to the science. I'm really excited to share with you from UC Berkeley Innovative Genomics Institute, where the home of CRISPR-Cas9 technology. I'm working at an institute where lots of gene editing research happens, and I happen to be in the division that's focused on agricultural improvements. And so it's really exciting to be at the home of where this technology emerged from as we consider how we can apply it for agricultural improvement. And so my research is twofold. I try and focus kind of reviewing and systematically on how gene editing has been applied in agriculture and how it'll enable future innovations, and then also have a research program in rice crop improvement. A little bit about my background. So I grew up on Long Island, New York, where my parents operated a small takeout lunch restaurant. So I grew up in the midst of food, and their number one selling item there was a Greek salad, which is fitting because they are immigrants from Cyprus. And their families were farming families. And so through many generations, I've been involved in food. And this is my kind of take on it now that I get to apply biotechnology and operating food systems. I was fortunate enough to attend Cornell University, where I joined a rice breeding lab and was able to explore how conventional breeding methods were able to be used or leveraged to improve rice crop. And when I transitioned to grad school, I was really interested in being able to continue working with rice, as it's the most globally important food crop, at least from a direct consumption perspective, and be able to explore how we can anticipate the implications of climate change and use gene editing instead of conventional breeding to advance crop quality and performance. And so what we learned through a systematic review that I did alongside some folks at the Alliance for Science was we really were inspired by the range of technology and innovations that existed in the space from crops and livestock. We were able to survey the literature and determine that there has been such an amazing array of innovations that exist from staple crops all the way to ground cherries, which are not widely domesticated crops, and in a wide array of livestock organisms as well. And what we were excited to see was that many of the traits that had been edited converged on four major traits: abiotic stress tolerance, nutritional quality improvement, disease tolerance, and yield improvements. And these are all traits that stand to be really severely affected by climate change. So we're excited to see that the literature has reported on amazing innovations like the ones that Macy and Navneet have shared with us, for being able to address climate change and other demands on the food system using gene editing. And that inspiration about the array of things that existed motivates me in my own work in rice drought tolerance. And so I focus on structures. I'm a developmental geneticist, and I focus on structures called stomata, which are the important sites for gas exchange. It's where carbon dioxide enters the plants for photosynthesis, but they're also the major sites of water loss. And rice plants specifically, about 90% of all water lost occurs via stomata. And so my hope is to be able to understand the fundamental genetics of stomatal development in rice so that we might be able to engineer a rice crop that displays improved drought tolerance while also maintaining yields. As we know, climate change will impact our water and our rainfall. And so there'll be more erratic periods of rainfall, and there will be more severe episodes of drought. The major rice producing regions of the world are already experiencing water scarcity. And so this technology is really important for the present day, as well as for future climate conditions. And so I was able to explore a mobile patterning factor called EPF10, which is thought to have played a role in the development of stomata in rice plants. And using CRISPR-Cas9, I was able to knock out this gene and generate plants with modest reductions in stomatal density. As a result of generating those plants, we were able to test to what capacity they're able to yield similarly, perform photosynthesis similarly, and also ultimately conserve water. And really excitingly, we found that these lines that we had generated With modest reductions in stomatal density, we're able to conserve more water than the wild type while also performing the same level of photosynthesis and stomatal conductance, two very important parameters for yield as the wild type, and had all the wild type physiology from thermoregulation to yield. So we're really excited by this data, and what's moving forward, we'll be able to actually field trial these varieties that we developed in collaboration with CIAT, an institution in Colombia, that is then able to integrate this technology into their future breeding programs should it be successful in the field. So from a systematic consideration, gene editing has been really powerful, at least in the literature, for providing solutions to climate change. And then from my research program, we've seen how a single gene edit has been really promising in showing drought tolerance. So I'm excited to be here with the rest of the panelists and continue sharing with you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholas. And thank you all for those great overviews. I would encourage all of our listeners to jump into the chat boxes and the Q&A boxes on your platform and go ahead and post your questions. We'll get to in a moment. So we'll get to some of those technical questions. But first, I wanted to ask each of you, all of whom are working to address some pretty big challenges in food and agriculture. And Nicholas, you touched on this already a little bit. So I'll start with Macy and Navneet, and then if you want to add something, Nicholas. I'm just curious, what motivates you to pursue your science? And what, or otherwise said, what motivates you as a scientist? Macy, do you want to kick that off?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it's the reason we get out of bed every day and go do what we do. So it's important. And I would say as a scientist, I'm really motivated by the adventure of discovery and just understanding more about nature and how we can use that to both steward our natural resources and improve both animal and human well-being. And then a little bit more as an agriculturalist and specifically a geneticist, what really excites me about genetics is that compared to other inputs such as nutrition or things like that, which require constant input, genetics can build upon themselves as a cumulative gain. And so we can continue to build on that improvement. And so that's what makes me really excited about my particular field.
Beautifully put. That's inspiring. For anyone out there who wants to get into genetics, they need to talk to Macy. All right, Navneet, what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
If I say I don't have to go far to get motivation, I belong to a farmer's family. My family do agriculture, and I have seen them going through so many troubles, and I have seen many people like leaving agriculture because there are so many problems. And when I stepped into science and I learned about this, like, follicular seizures, and I was very like excited, and I wanted to do something which can help to improve this agriculture. So I really look, whenever I feel like I cannot do this, but I look towards my family, I look to my family, and I see that they need this technology to be provided to them. So I can say that's my motivation, my family.
That's great. Great. Nicholas, anything to add?
I'm so inspired by the stories of people like Navneet, and have seen firsthand how, you know, my farming family back in Cyprus has benefited from technology, and have been so inspired by what we've already achieved and want to keep driving that torch forward.
Great. Thank you all for those inspiring words. I love this wild ride of discovery. I'm just turning here to some of the more technical questions that we have coming in. So we have a couple of questions for Navneet. She's already answered one through chat about, you know, Jennifer Thompson asks, is she correct that you use classical GM technology to increase the activity of the first gene you mentioned? And Navneet has confirmed yes. We have a question here coming in from Facebook Live for Navneet as well that says, asks about the existing banana variety that has more vitamin A that was found. Is this variety grown in a certain area, or does it have any cultural significance? And then she goes on to ask, are there implications for the cooking acceptability of the orange vitamin? a enhanced banana. Navneet, do you want to address that one?
Yes. First of all, the Nandan variety, which has the highest carotenoid content, I found is a cooking banana, and it is also lightly orange in color. But since studies have shown that cooking reduces the content of carotenoids in the plant and hence the bioavailability of the carotenoid, so to get that carotenoid content into the like eatable these dessert bananas, so it's good to transfer that genes to the dessert bananas, and which can be easily consumed and which don't have to be cooked. And about the perspective about this cooking, this orange colored banana, I think people love colorful fruits. And since Nandan is also quite orange in color, so people cook it and it's a cooking banana. So I think accepting this colorful banana is no problem.
But certainly there are always social considerations, and I think we'll continue to talk about that across the hour. I want to turn to this question from Luciano, which, you know, brings up some of the policy issues. So Macy, good thing you got that minor in political science as an undergrad. So this is the question. Do you, and first compliments to your presentations, do you see or believe that in the future, the governments around the world will give authorization to apply gene editing in commercial farms? I mean, in the future, will we be able to find in supermarkets meat, milk, and vegetables that have been gene edited? Who wants to jump on that one first? Go ahead, Macy. Use that minor.
So I'll primarily speak from the livestock point of view, but there are currently gene edited or actually genetic engineered plants on the market. But that's a different story for livestock. And so regarding the current status of gene editing regulation is it really depends on the country that you're in for livestock right now. So several countries in South America and Canada have product-based regulatory systems where they look at the product to determine if it's novel compared to what you can do conventionally bred, and that's how they decide how it should be regulated. Some countries like the US, for instance, are currently in the process of still developing their regulations, but as of now, gene edited plants that could be made through conventional breeding are allowed into the marketplace. However, gene edited animals are have to go through a very strict, actually similar to a drug regulatory approval. And so that will be a big hindrance in the US compared to other countries. So that's kind of the current status. As for the future, I think that a big part of it will depend on what traits animal breeders and producers decide to target. So there's been many studies that show consumers are very interested and accepting when the traits are helping the animal itself. So something like pulled, or potentially improving the food product, again, for consumers, like eliminating an allergen. So I think that by choosing to target traits that are more consumer or animal beneficial, then consumers will vote with their dollar per se, and their voices. And so we can start to have a broader discussion in certain countries that aren't currently as open.
Great, thanks. Great explanation. Any other perspectives from our other panelists?
Sure, I would just love to amplify everything that Macy said and bring a little bit of that crop perspective. In Japan, we're really excited to see the first gene edited product reaching market. It's a biofortified tomato. It has increased levels of GABA. So these products are coming to us, and each place, like Macy mentioned, will have a different approach to how they'll arrive at your dinner tables. But I certainly hope in the future these products can reach our supermarkets and our shelves and have a place in our lives, just like other crops that have benefited from biotechnology have reached our tables.
That's great. Thanks. You know, it was fascinating to sort of see the pathway from you know, very fundamental concepts to the greenhouse that we saw with in Navneet's presentation. You know, the science can be tedious and complex, and there are lots of bumps along the way, from all the way from, you know, discovery in the lab to delivery. to the farmers that are motivating each of you. So when you think about those challenges, both in the lab and in the field and in delivery, how many of those challenges are technical or scientific, and how many are more societal or political? And maybe you could add your perspective on what role scientists should have in addressing the latter, these societal and political challenges and issues. And I think that gets to one of the questions that we have in the Q&A, you know, how are each of you working to address public perception? And this question is specific to GM technologies, but maybe we could broaden that out to, you know, all biotechnologies. Who wants to take a first stab at that? Just take a piece of it.
I think scientists are like always working in one corner, and the communication part is given to other people. But I think scientists need to come in front and communicate to the society, and society makes the politics actually. So if you address your concern, if you explain your science in layman language to the society, I think politics can be changed. So I think scientists need to come forward and communicate in simple layman language before the opposite side explain it in their way. So I think communication plays important role, and scientists need to come in front and explain what they're doing.
Great. Nicholas, Macy?
I would love to take a swing at that first part of the question about technical versus other challenges ahead of us. I think there is always a frontier to pursue, right? There's always a mechanism for improving technology. There's always a mechanism for improving public perception. And I think each one of us has to consider where we want to be in that journey and that overall scheme. When we reviewed the literature that told us about gene editing in agriculture, of course, there was future opportunities of how this technology could be applied. But there's also a beautiful array of things in existence that haven't made it to farmers' hands yet. And so from my perspective, there are opportunities on both fronts, and we all can decide to what extent we want to take on those battles. But I'm excited for the future of the field regardless.
Great. Thanks for that. Macy, you want to add anything here?
Yeah, I definitely agree with what Nicholas said, and I'll kind of jump on what Namvit said as far as communication being key. And I think that an important strategy that we're learning and trying to implement is that it's not just sharing our science, but also listening to the consumer or the public as to what interests they have, and finding that common ground is where we can then build from there to be able to have these innovations reach the market.
That's great. I'm so glad you brought up the importance of listening in communication. I couldn't agree with you more. We have a question here from Aruna, who asks, current trend is that gene-edited products are more easily accepted than genetically engineered crops. As shown in Avneet's work, overexpression by classical GE produces procedures are still very essential. So how do we want to make a case for acceptance of all types of genetic modifications and not exclusively market acceptance of a gene-edited product? I see Nicholas nodding. Do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. I completely agree. And the proof is before us, right? There's amazing technology that exists using genetic modification, but we also have seen what that has looked like in terms of consumer acceptance and the political and socio-political campaigns that exist against that technology. And I think gene editing is a really important opportunity for a second chance. And we see that as gene editing or biotechnology broadly becomes more intimate in each of our lives, there are opportunities to expand what additional technology will become included in our lives. So COVID-19 saw the largest and fastest distribution of a biotechnological approach through vaccination. And as a result, we're seeing trends that are encouraging for all types of biotechnology. And as gene editing becomes unrolled, and because it has a favorable regulatory landscape that surrounds it, I feel hopeful that the following breakthrough might be in actually consumer acceptance of genetic modification. So I think I'm excited to be pursuing gene editing work because it feels like the path of least resistance, at least right now, from a regulatory perspective. But I remain hopeful that genetic modification may also become a tool that can arrive in consumers' plates as well.
That's great. And I think the arrival on consumers' plate is a key point. I see a question coming in from one of the world's biggest banana fans out there that I've ever met, Patricia Nanteza from Uganda, where banana is king. And she says to Navneet, presumably, which is your target country for the release of the vitamin A enhanced banana?
Right now, these bananas are under field trials. And once they are approved, and the very first target will be the India, obviously. But yes, it will be open to be provided to different countries where banana is a major staple crop. That's the target. But I'm very hopeful that these bananas pass these field trials to different acclimatization condition and environments. Yes.
Great. Thank you. So Nicholas, I have a specific question for you. We've seen sort of we've talked about the importance of communication, and of course, we know that you know, most of us can only handle so much data, if you will. And I think you know it's important for us to understand the difficult process of science and the importance of basic research that may or may not actually translate to something that's useful for society. And we've certainly seen that with COVID-19, the importance of that basic mRNA research and how that ultimately did translate many years later into the vaccines that have spared many lives. So I find your research fascinating. You're essentially trying to change the pore density on a leaf to render it more adapted to water stress. That's an incredible feat. And no doubt that requires a lot of basic research that we didn't sort of hear all about today. And all of that is such an important part of ultimately seeing a rice plant in the hands of farmers, what motivates you. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of both basic and translational or applied research and their complementary role in ensuring impact in the world?
Definitely. Thank you for that question. I'm somebody who's been inspired by both sides of the coin, right? I've been excited about what this technology can achieve for us in terms of agriculture, but you know, I fell in love with a tiny protein, and that's what I've spent the past 4 years really investing a lot of my time in studying. And I think these things don't have to be mutually exclusive. There's synergism between fundamental and applied research. When Jennifer Doudna first started trying to understand CRISPR-Cas systems, that was just a weird pattern that someone detected in genomes over and over again. And she was curious about it. She had no concept that it would have become the tool in, you know, revolutionizing agriculture and medicine that it is today. And so I think we should all chase what inspires us. And sometimes it's that really applied work. And sometimes it's studying that small peptide that is important in developmental genetics. But I don't think there needs to be a dichotomy between the two. I think they really feed each other. And we've seen that time and time again, whether it be an mRNA vaccine or the very technology that we're discussing, CRISPR-Cas9. I am grateful for all the science that exists because we all stand on each other's shoulders and will continue to proceed, I think, with that understanding that all types of science are valuable.
That's great. Thanks. I have a question for you, Navneet. I think it's easier maybe for many of us to think about the direct link of something like water stress, drought tolerance linked with climate change. But can you share with us and talk about how nutrition is very much affected by climate change and how it will be exacerbated by climate change?
It's very simple that if climate changes, temperature increases, there will be effect on the crop yields. And once a crop yield is affected, it will lead to food and financial insecurity. And food and financial insecurity will make people to choose their food, and especially in developing countries where it already very limited resources for the food, if they have, they still have to make food choices, there will be obviously nutritional issues, there will be deficiency issues, especially, and there is also a report where they say that with increasing level of carbon dioxide, there will be decline in the nutrition of certain legumes, especially iron and zinc. So populations in many developing countries, they have their iron and zinc from the legume crops. And if there is decline, so there will be more cases of iron and zinc deficiency. And in high income countries, there will be like due to climate change, there will be reduced consumption of vegetables and the fruits, and which will lead to other diet-associated non-communicable diseases such as diabetes 2 or cardiovascular diseases and many more. So yes, this climate change will affect the nutrition in crops and specifically in different parts of world differently.
Thanks, Navneet. Macy, I want to turn to you and talk about this difference between, you know, different parts of the world. How do you see gene editing as it's being applied to livestock in the US as compared to how it's being applied or the potential for the developing world? So how do the challenges and the opportunities for editing livestock compare in those two different settings?
Yeah, that's a really great and I think an important question as we move forward. And so similar to what Nicholas found with the crop side of things, gene editing experiments in livestock and particularly cattle have primarily focused on three main areas of improvement. So that's animal health and welfare, product yield or quality, and then reproduction or novel breeding schemes. And these are all highly aligned with the goals of conventional breeding programs, and these traits could be beneficial all around the globe. But the importance of the traits might differ, and how they're implemented will also probably differ. So one thing I think it's important to keep in mind is that gene editing is kind of the cherry on top of the animal breeding sundae. And so in order for gene editing to really be used to its full potential, it needs to be used in combination with other genetic and reproductive biotechnologies. And things like genomic selection to identify the best candidates for gene editing. So not only are the gene edited traits, but also the best genetics overall are being passed to that next generation. And that's how we continue genetic improvement. And so I think that's what will mainly look different around the globe. So in a country like the United States, where there's pretty structured breeding programs and depending on dairy versus beef adoption of reproductive technologies, gene editing will be able to simultaneously enter those systems and continue improving the genetics of the population, as well as adding in those beneficial traits for tackling challenges like disease resistance and things. But in some other countries where maybe their livestock industries are less developed, I actually think that before jumping into gene editing, an important component will be investing more research into the genomic selection side of things. And so that is being able to look at the DNA of an animal and determine its genetic potential. So like I said, to be able to identify those best animals before choosing which ones to gene edit. And so this is a pretty big question, but those are just a couple of the differences I can see. But the exciting part about gene editing in developing or tropical countries is that it can be used to adapt local breeds rather than having to import genetics from, say, temperate climates. So that is one exciting thing I see.
Thanks for that, Macy. And I love that you've emphasized the importance of, you know, using a lot of tools to solve a problem. I want to address this question that's come in from Busani, and then we'll come to a close soon here. Busani asks, the world is racing to meet food demand for a growing population. How do you see gene editing contributing to the production of more healthy food at a time of food loss? and then raises this issue of food waste. So how, and I think that's an issue that we haven't talked a lot about during this hour, how could gene editing contribute to reducing food waste? I'll leave that open for anyone to jump in on.
Mainly genome editing can help increase the shelf life of the food, like especially in case of tomato, as they haven't. So as the shelf life of the vegetables or these tomatoes or any fruits or vegetables can be increased, so it will help reduce the food waste problem. And the genome editing can also help increasing this yield and can provide. So I think genome editing can help in this time of food scarcity, as well as saving us from food loss and food waste.
Thanks, Navneet. Yeah, certainly that ties back into the nutrition challenge, doesn't it? Okay, we're at the end of our time together. I want to end with one last question for all of you. Just want a brief response from each of you on what your biggest hopes for the future of gene editing and food and agriculture are. I mean, you are the future of gene editing and agriculture. And so what are your biggest hopes for this tool as it applies to food and agriculture? And I will start with you, Macy.
Hey. So for this question, I really hope that gene editing will be used to tackle challenging and currently invasive issues in livestock, such as animal health and welfare issues, like thermotolerance and disease resistance. And these traits, especially given that the novel environmental conditions that are resulting from a changing climate are outpacing the adaptive capacity of livestock. And so the rapid trait introduction enabled through gene editing, I think, will be a really crucial tool for accelerating climate adaption of livestock. And I also hope that the relatively low cost of this technology, specifically CRISPR, will allow widespread and equitable use of the technology.
Great. Navneet.
I hope for the climate smart super varieties, where we have to invest less into the land and the pesticide, but on the same, they are resistant to this upcoming climate conditions and can help us provide food security in next coming years.
Excellent. Thank you, Navneet. And Nicholas, what are your hopes for the future?
My vision for this technology is to see it distributed equitably and to be given the capacity to make the change that's important for every community that seeks to be affected by climate change, which is every single one. So my hope is to see gene editing, like conventional breeding, make its stay globally and in all the communities that could stand to benefit from it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your perspectives and your research with us today. Ladies and gentlemen out there in the world, thank you so much for joining us. These are three stars to watch. So we'll continue to watch your careers and look for those stories of impact coming out of your labs. Wishing everyone a happy new year. Again, thank you for joining us today on AFS Live. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.